This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. Arthur Levitt is a former chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, a Bloomberg LP board member, a senior advisor to the Promontory Financial Group, and a policy advisor to Goldman Sachs.
Will Steger's list of accomplishments spans poles and decades. He and his team were the first explorers confirmed to reach the North Pole by dog sled without resupply. He led the first team to attempt the grueling 7-month, 3,700-mile crossing of Antarctica. In 1995, he led a 1,200-mile expedition between Russia and Ellesmere Island, Canada, via dog sleds with a team of 5 educators and scientists. Steger joined Jacques Cousteau, Dr. Thor Heyerdahl, and Neil Armstrong in receiving the Lindbergh Award, given for his numerous polar expeditions, his deep understanding of the environment, and efforts to raise awareness of current environmental threats, especially climate change. Steger holds a Bachelor of Science in Geology and Master of Arts in Education from the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's the author of 4 books, Over the Top of the World, Crossing Antarctica, North to the Pole, and Saving the Earth. Now, I haven't been to the North Pole, Will, but I've been taking groups of people to a wilderness location every year for decades. So I'm particularly honored to have the world expert on wilderness trips here to tell me about his life. And I'm curious to know what got you started to be an explorer.
I started very young. I'm from Minnesota, so that might explain my affinity to cold weather. But my dad was an entrepreneur, fought in the World War II, came back, started a company. He raised his 9 kids through his ideas, but we were given pretty much total freedom as young kids, and I started exploring. Actually, I went down the Mississippi River from Minneapolis to New Orleans and back in a motorboat when I was 15, and I started climbing when I was 16, and I've been exploring ever since, and I just followed my curiosity and my love for the wilderness, and particularly my love for the northern wilderness and the colder climate. So. And I've made a livelihood out of it. I'm an educator, and the last 25 years through the internet, I've been able to bring audiences of the public and children along on my expedition. So I've kind of stayed true to my vision all my life on this, and continue exploring today.
It wasn't until you were 39 that you decided to attempt the North Pole. Why did you want to do it? And what did you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, when I was 39, actually, I was right a year and a half before that, I was on a year and a half expedition, 7,000 miles by dogs. And it was really my first real major dog sled expedition where I traveled thousands of miles. And it was on that expedition, in a big storm, I conceived of doing the North Pole. Prior to that, I thought it was, I wasn't really attracted to the goal. A goal of doing the pole, but I realized that it had never been done unsupported, and almost everyone said that was impossible. And I felt that I could do that. I felt I was a piece of history that if I could get it organized. So when I got back from the expedition, made a contact with National Geographic, and they took me and committed to a story. DuPont Insulation was one of my major sponsors, and had a lot of the media followed me, and it was a personal best in ways. Historically, I mean, I've read all the journals and historical records of all the expeditions, but I wanted in my own mind, first of all, to see if Perry actually made the pole, did what he did, said he did, Perry or Cook, and I felt I would have to do it unsupported, traveling by sextant only, in order to shed light on that controversy. So that was one of the issues, but it was really a personal best. I knew if I could make the pole, I was at 41 when I made it, that it would also open up other opportunities, expeditions to Antarctica and other things I wanted to do.
What was your most enjoyable trek? Not necessarily the most scientifically successful, but your really favorite place?
Yeah, my favorite place is really the Canadian Arctic and the High Arctic in Canada, Ellesmere Island. And I had that expedition when I was 37, year and a half, where we traveled. We just saved up our money for 2 or 3 years. We didn't have sponsors, so there wasn't any pressure. We didn't have a radio. We were off in 300-400 miles from the nearest, you know, village, and we lived off the land for part of that expedition in the wintertime. And that was really quite remarkable. I actually came of age on that expedition. And then my best expedition I felt that I'd done was the crossing of Antarctica in 89-90. That was a 7-month expedition. Antarctica had never been crossed by dogs or, you know, or anyone hauling at that time. And I purposely took the longest possible route. And we did an international team of 6 people from 6 countries. And that one had a great purpose. So the renewal of the Antarctic Treaty was coming up in 1990, which was the year of that expedition. And Antarctica was actually going to be open up for exploration of minerals, which would have changed everything in Antarctica, not only the environment, but back in 90, we needed that scientific study and that effort from all countries to get data about to show that climate change was real. So, but we draw world attention to the treaty and to treaty review at that time. We met the world leaders of the time, and we were able to actually to move that treaty review into the preservation of Antarctica so we could study, concentrate on more on the science.
We'll continue this conversation in a moment with polar explorer, educator, and author Will Steger. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 12 minutes past the hour. This is A Closer Look at polar explorer Will Steger. We're talking about his experiences in the wilderness, climate change, and clean energy solutions. I'm Arthur Levitt. Well, my next trip on my annual wilderness jaunts is to Yellowknife in the Canadian Arctic. Have you been in this area? And the age range of the people on the trip is 18 to 86. You think they're all able to make it?
Yes, I've been in that area many times. That's kind of the center of the bridging off point for the Canadian Barrens. The wildlife in this region, like you're going to observe, are incredible. And yeah, of course, it's people of all age. I mean, it depends on, you know, you won't be hauling probably big sleds, but to travel by canoe and hiking and that, anyone that's up to 80, you know, as long as you can move, you're capable of going up there. And it's a very inspirational area to go to, meeting the people, but also getting out into the Barrens and seeing the wildlife. It's going to be a pretty good, incredible experience for your crew there.
What kind of wildlife do you think we'll see?
You'll probably mostly see caribou. There's huge herds of caribou. There's musk oxen, huge animals, buffalo-sized animals. And you may see bears. You know, there's some grizzlies there, and also wolves. I mean, we've run into a lot of wolves when we dog sled through there. But for sure, I you'll see caribou, and I probably would see, if you're moving around, you certain areas, you will see the musk ox.
Oh, that's great. Where do you think we should think about going the following year? What kind of extreme wilderness is accessible for kind of regular people that go on these trips?
Yeah, you know, there's a most incredible experience, I think, too, that's open to someone from the public is taking a ship to Antarctica from southern Chile, Asian Argentina, or Chile. And that's a one-of-a-lifetime opportunity. Some of the trips on there are reasonably priced, you know, around $4,000 or $5,000. It's a bit of an investment, but it's something that you'll never forget, and you'll become forever an ambassador of that continent when you see it.
What's the minimum time that such a trip would take?
The minimum time on that expedition to Antarctica, probably about 10 days, I would say.
Now, I think I'm told that you're also a photographer. I'm curious, what camera do you generally use? And do you have any particular tips for amateur nature photographers?
Yeah, I've photographed most of my life, and I brought cameras, both video cameras and still cameras, down to probably some of the coldest temperatures that pictures have ever been taken on a consistent basis. I mean, I didn't step out from a warm house. I was traveling, had to keep these cameras going. And in the days when I shot film, I would use the Nikon FM2, which is a very simple camera. Electronics do not work unless you can heat them up. Back then I would, the light meters wouldn't work. So, you know, I was good at bracketing and just judging the setting. And the problem in action photography like that is a dog falls in a crevasse, for example. It's always the most difficult time to film, but those are the times when you really got to get that camera. It's that time when you don't want to film, but things are happening that you really got to make that effort. It takes a huge effort to photograph in the cold. But most cameras now, you can heat the cameras up with there's certain types of hand warmers that you can use. We have specialized, almost like a blanket that goes around the cameras. But I've been able to shoot down to 72 below zero on film and down to about 55 below zero with both video and digital. And that's consistent. That's day after day of shooting like that, which takes a lot of camera preparation.
When you first started giving climate change presentations, you chose conservative church congregations. What issues were they most receptive to, and why did you choose churches as opposed to schools or other venues?
Most of my presentations, even today, I prefer to talk to conservative audiences. I mean, I can preach to the choir, but you get a good response. But I have to go where I feel I have to go, that where, you know, there's really got to be some information to get across. And I approach the conservative churches because, for myself, climate change is the moral issue. It's really, for myself, it's about mass extinction. I mean, it's something that we're causing, and something that we definitely have solutions for.
Don't you think minority communities or Jewish temples, for instance, would be responsive to this as well?
Yes, I did. I have been in a lot of Jewish temples, and of all sorts, actually. And because once you get climate change, if you understand it or you feel it as a moral issue, then you're totally committed. And I've seen whole congregations just really change right around in terms of looking at what could they do for solutions and so forth. And there's a lot of influential people also in congregations too.
That's really fascinating. You say that part of the problem with getting action on climate change is that America is socially disconnected. What does that mean, socially disconnected?
The solution to climate change, one of the solutions is bound in social interaction. And I see this in churches, that in congregations, that once they catch on, once they see it as a moral issue, they immediately start connecting socially, getting solutions, people connecting. And it's pretty obvious. And I mean, I was raised since, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And we had a very socially connected society. The society did things together, and I'm not sure what the cause, but in the 70s, 80s, 90s, people got more disconnected. And but I see it firsthand that around climate, people are really connecting, and that social connection is a really important, real powerful force.
He spent 50 years traveling in the Arctic as an eyewitness to global warming. In 2007, National Geographic presented him with their Lifetime Achievement Award for his work on climate change. Polar explorer Will Steger will return for part two of this interview next week at this same time. By the way, if you have any comments about the show or suggestions about topics, please email me at aclosterlook@blumberg.net. That's a closer look, one word, at blumberg.net. And follow me on Twitter @ArthaLevitt. One word. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 25 minutes past the hour.
This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. Arthur Levitt is a former chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, a Bloomberg LP board member, a senior advisor to the Promontory Financial Group, and a policy advisor to Goldman Sachs.
This week, we continue our closer look at explorer Will Steger, best known for his legendary polar explorations. He's traveled tens of thousands of miles by kayak and dog sled over 50 years, leading teams on some of the most significant polar explorations. His foundation, Climate Generation, is his Minneapolis, Minnesota-based nonprofit that educates and empowers people to engage in solutions to climate change. He also designed the Steger Wilderness Center in Ely, Minnesota, built to be a living example of ecological stewardship. Will, dogs pervade your stories, your explorations, your trips. As a fellow dog lover, I have to assume you really care for these animals. Are they first and foremost pets, or are they employees, or are they a little of both? Do you have one of these dogs sleeping by your bedside every night?
Well, a sled dog, where you're relying on this dog for your life, and, you know, it's a different relation. It's not a pet relation. It's not a real working dog. It is a working dog relationship. But that there's a a very strong bond. I mean, if you can say respect, you know, I have a deep respect for the spirit and the commitment of the dogs, and I think they, you know, in that animal type of a sense, have a respect for you. As long as you're caring for them, they're totally loyal. My whole success in the polar regions have been really due to our dogs, and that success has been because we've taken such great care of the dogs that enable them to really perform for us.
What do you do when the dog is no longer able to work with you?
Your dog's good for an expedition to about 8. We might keep some of the dogs to train the puppies, but then we have a retirement program for them. Generally, people in the suburbs, in the city that have kids. So we always have a list of people that want these dogs, and they're assured of a really good second life, actually, with families, and they respond very well to the special attention. They're very humble animals and very appreciative of anything that people do for them. And so they go on, you know, afterwards. A lot of them live to be, you know, 14 to 16 years old, so they have a second life, a little more comfortable life in a social atmosphere.
Do you have any as pets?
No, I don't. You know, I live in the wilderness, so it kind of doesn't allow you to have a lot of extra animals like that. But I do, some of these dogs I really miss, and I've written a lot of stories about these dogs, and I'm actually working on a book about these dogs. So, and I'm deeply, deeply committed to the and appreciative of these animals.
A lot of what you've done deals with the economic case for action in terms of climate change, and we've all heard about fracking by now. Frackers would argue that what they're doing reduces the use of coal now that natural gas is cheaper. Do you believe that fracking can be done responsibly, or if you had a magic wand, would you wave it so that there'd be no further fracking?
Yeah, I'm a geologist, so I have a little bit more of an understanding. Fracking is, certain areas, fracking does not pollute if it's way below, you know, and it has capped by certain geology. But other areas where it's near the water table, it's quite dangerous because it does can permanently pollute the water. So it's not a straight on silver bullet. It works in areas and it has definitely reduced the cost of natural gas. Natural gas is a bridging fuel for now until one of the bridging fuels to move away from coal and to move away from carbon. But at the same time, we have to look at solar and wind and the economy of that. But what's closing down, you know, a majority of these coal plants is really the low cost of natural gas, and it's out competing coal, and coal is no longer competitive, and no one's investing in coal for that reason.
Do you think the coal business essentially is over?
It's moving. It's not going to totally close down, but we're seeing it. However, I would say in the future, coal is a valuable commodity, and it can be used for structural. And in a future where we can, you know, live in a cleaner world, where when we're using products like coal, where we can keep the fumes out of the atmosphere, I think there's a long range future for coal. But the coal as we know it now as energy, I think, is on its way out in the United States. And I don't think there's any way avoiding that because it's economic. And it's a real problem if you're in West Virginia. I mean, it's very serious with the families there. I mean, I live on the Iron Range of northern Minnesota, and I see a lot of times the layoffs and so forth, and I have deep compassion for these people. But it's a changing world. It's a changing technology, and coal is on its way out.
This week, we continue our closer look at explorer Will Steger, best known for his legendary polar explorations. He's traveled tens of thousands of miles by kayak and dog sled over 50 years, leading teams on some of the most significant polar expeditions in history. His foundation, Climate Generation, is his Minneapolis, Minnesota-based nonprofit that educates and empowers people to engage in solutions to climate change. He also designed the Steger Wilderness Center in Ely, Minnesota, built to be a living example of ecological stewardship. We'll continue this conversation with polar explorer, climate change activist, educator Will Steger in a moment. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 12 minutes past the hour. This is a closer look at legendary polar explorer Will Steger, who's now focusing his energies on raising public awareness of the risks posed by climate change and the solutions. Will, do you think the politicians get it, or do you think there's only a rare few that care enough about battling back against the enormous moneyed interests that really don't want to see efforts to preserve our climate, which may interfere with their bottom line profits?
Yep. I think, you know, I do think most politicians get it. That's one thing that they get it. And the other is where's their alliance? But I've always approached this to economics. Because the solutions are economical. And if we can create an economy, when we are creating a new clean energy economy, and not just energy, but it's this whole infrastructure change that we're seeing that's providing huge numbers of jobs. And it is part of our financial future. And by creating the new industry around clean energy and low carbon economy, that's something that most politicians can buy into. As an example, in Minnesota, we're nearing a billion-dollar industry now in clean energy, low-carbon economy. And this industry didn't hardly exist 8 years ago. We're employing a lot of people, and we're building constituency around that. And as a result, more of the politicians are on board because it's creating jobs. So I don't really argue with a lot of people on, you know, denying or whatever. I mean, I agree to disagree with some people, but I always approached the solutions through the economics. And that's something that I think all politicians will listen to. So that's the direction I go, and that's my hope.
Do women care about this issue as much as men?
I would say so, yeah. The younger people, I've rarely had a climate argument with a younger person. A younger person understands this, and it's their future. That's why I'm in this game. That's why I see the hope in this, but it's really the younger people that I get my inspiration from.
Do you think that fracking can be done responsibly?
It can be done in certain areas. It all depending on the geology. In the west, where the fracking is deeper and there's rocks that cap, it can be done responsibly. But in certain areas of Pennsylvania, for example, out east, a lot of the groundwater there is being contaminated, and fracking does use a lot of water, which is a valuable resource. But natural gas is a bridging fuel right now, and without fracking, we'd be, you know, the coal would be, you know, still in power, and the pollution from that is just really drastic. It is a bridging technology and a bridging fuel, but we need to look forward into, you know, an economy that does not rely on fossil fuels for its energy, in an economy that's going to employ more of our people. If you look at the numbers that are employed in the coal industry versus the solar and the wind, it's almost two or three times more people employed in those industries right now, and it's still just beginning.
Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic. I mean, we are going to have to adapt. The changes are realistic, real, and they're coming, and they're coming faster than most people realize. But I'm optimistic. You know, the human spirit, our ability, it's economic. So, you know, within economics, it's competitive. There's incentives. That's what's going to drive, you know, drive this change. You bring carbon out of the atmosphere through the economics of the cleaner technologies. I'm very, very optimistic in that. But like expeditions, all my life I've sought out the edge, like in climbing. And when you're on your edge, you've got to be 100% right on spiritually, mentally, physically. And if you're not, you know, there's a good chance that you may not be living very long. And that's where the learning for me has been. And I see the human race right now, we're on that edge. It's very serious. But I have faith in the spirit that when we're on this edge, it's going to force us to be at our best, and that we are going to overcome and to adapt around this problem. The world may change some, but we still can maintain the lifestyle that we have, but we don't have to consume as much. And I think that's a great thing.
We need an enlightened business community that may see a conflict between their economic interests and their civic responsibility. Bill Gates just launched a $1 billion fund that's going to finance emerging energy innovations. And Elon Musk, the developer of the Tesla car, is investing in solar and battery technology. Do you believe that business leaders can go a long way towards solving climate change before it's too late?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the business leaders that are going to make the difference here in their decisions, because this is a huge business proposition, a lot to gain from it. And if it wasn't a business issue, you know, really, I wouldn't be here talking about this. And I think a lot of our business leaders are coming around. I mean, you can look at the major corporations; they understand what's going on with the climate, and they're taking steps around it. Not just because it's only the right thing to do, but it's the best thing to do for their bottom line. So you can do what's best for your bottom line at the same time being socially responsible with your action and in the example that you're setting for other people.
Will you speak with incredible passion, and that goes with your life stories and the mission that you're on? Educator, activist, photographer, entrepreneur, Will Sager is best known for his legendary polar explorations. You're the fourth person ever to reach both poles, leading teams on some of the most significant expeditions in history. And I have to say, everyone in this audience and in this country owes you a great debt for your devotion to climate change, education, activism, and solutions. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, this means a lot to me. Thank you so much for the interview.
By the way, if you have any comments about the show or suggestions about topics, please email me at aclosterlook@blumberg.net. That's a closer look. One word at Bloomberg.net. And follow me on Twitter at Arthur Levitt. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 25 minutes past the hour.